Sherlock Holmes in the Blackout Ripper by Scott McQuaid, produced by Pop-Up Theatre.
Quickly! Watson, this way!
Slow down, Holmes.
Over here!
Wait.
Come on, Watson!
It was World War II, and the rain of bombing had started particularly early that night. London had entered the dark days of the Blitz, whereby the city was attacked with aerial bombardment for 57 consecutive days from German forces. They called this attack Blitzkrieg, the Lightning War.
Are you okay?
Yes, yes. Where are we?
In an air raid shelter. I remember passing it earlier, when I went to meet Mycroft.
Well, the Jerrys are really going for it tonight. Looks like they've passed. Shall we go? Sherlock did not answer, which prompted me to turn around. Only I saw nothing. Nothing but the pitch blackness before me. As I entered further into the dark, damp air raid shelter, a cold chill came over me, that familiar feeling that I was about to encounter something unpleasant. Holmes! Holmes! Are you there? I can't see a damn thing in here.
Over here, Watson.
I followed the torchlight ahead until I came to what it was illuminating. There, upon the ground, was the body of a woman, lying on her back in the gutter. Is she dead?
Yes.
The following morning was bitter cold. It had snowed the night before. The date was Monday, February the 9th, 1942, and a crowd of onlookers had gathered outside the air raid shelter. There was a shortage of manpower in the police force due to the war sign-ups. The police struggled to contain the chaos, for this was not a casualty caused by the aftermath of bombing. It was something far more sinister and disturbing, and the general public sensed this.
Morning, chaps.
A rather dishevelled Inspector Lestrade approached us in the crowded air raid shelter.
I got here as soon as I could. A lot of the roads are blocked with rubble. The city's been blown to pieces. So, is this her?
What gave it away? Her dead gaze, her motionless body, her lack of breathing, or the fact that she's a corpse?
Yes, I'm afraid she's been strangled.
Really?
Yes, his intent was one of a sexual nature.
How can you tell?
Her skirt has been hitched up, revealing her stockings and underwear. Her vest has been torn, exposing one breast. I'd say that suggested that the killer had a sexual motive. Wouldn't you?
Yes, of course. Anything else?
The killer is left-handed.
How do you know that?
Lestrade, it is my business to know what other people do not know. Now, the markings around her neck indicate that she was strangled from the front. The pressure points of bruising are mostly on her right side, which indicates he must be left-handed.
Oh, yeah. Any identification on her?
No, I'm afraid not.
Okay. We'll ask around the area, see if anyone knows who she is.
She's not from around here. She's from Newcastle.
How do you know that?
Her attire. If you had bothered to carry out a proper inspection of the victim, you'd note that the label on her skirt reads Bainbridge Drapiers and Fashion, which is one of the oldest clothes shops situated in Newcastle.
Oh, but maybe she bought it from there on a visit.
Lestrade, were you born this stupid, or did you take lessons?
Now, hang on a minute.
Look at the deep indented creases in the back of her skirt. This signifies that she has been seated for a very long time, on a journey, perhaps on a train or bus. Now, couple that with the clear complexion of her skin. This shows that she hails from somewhere with far less smog and pollution, like Newcastle.
Oh, yeah. Come on then, boys. Let's move her out of here.
I will accompany the body to the morgue to see what the autopsy report reveals. No, and Lestrade, make sure you call me the moment you find the next one.
Next what?
Well, body, of course. This is just the beginning.
The wartime blackout was intended to minimise outdoor light, to hinder the navigation of enemy aircraft. But in doing so, it opened a doorway for those that would conduct misdeeds that were best undertaken in the dark. Thus, shadowy street corners and sombre alleyways offered cover for prostitution, burglary, and murder. Crime had risen by 57% and occurrences of murder rose by 22%. Londoners lived in fear of German forces bombing their houses while they slept, and daily life was made even tougher with food rationing and a lack of basic necessities. The last thing its citizens needed was a vicious killer using its streets as a hunting ground.
"Here she is,"
said the mortician as he threw open the sheet covering our victim. Despite my medical background, I never got used to the cold, solitary silence of a morgue. Holmes stood over the body, quietly studying her as he smoked his pipe. "So, what's the post-mortem?"
"Death was by strangulation. He straddled her body and forced down."
"Don't waste my time with obvious details. Tell me something I do not know."
The mortician became increasingly nervous as he fumbled through the pages of his report.
Yes, Mr. Holmes. Judging by the contents we found in her stomach, she had eaten around 8 o'clock. The bruises show..."
"What did she eat?"
"What?"
"You did conduct a full examination, did you not?"
"Yes."
"Then what did the stomach consist of?"
Mostly vegetables. Carrots, cabbage, beetroots, water."
"May I?"
Holmes gestured to the mortician's file.
"Of course."
Sherlock pondered over it for a moment before abruptly snatching a photo of the victim from the report and heading towards the door.
"Come on, Watson. The game is afoot."
I found myself back at the air raid shelter in Montague Place, where we had originally found the ill-fated woman. Sherlock then frantically walked down the street away from the shelter. "Slow down, Sherlock!" Sherlock suddenly stopped in the middle of the street. I eventually caught up with him. "What are we doing here?"
"There are 3 restaurants located here, approximately a quarter of a mile from the air raid shelter where our victim was found. See, there is Montague Kitchen, the Marylebone, and Lion's Corner House. Now, judging by our victim's middle-class attire, I anticipate that she ate at the latter restaurant. Come on!"
Holmes and I entered the Lion's Corner House. It was not so much a restaurant as it was a tea shop. The shop was painted in white, with gold lettering across the top of the window. It was huge inside, with rows of 4 mica-topped tables. Usually it served sandwiches, biscuits, cakes, ice cream and jelly along with its tea, but due to the war rationing, such sweet delights were replaced with bland condiments to place upon dry bread. Through the endless sea of smoke from pipes and cigarettes appeared the maitre d'.
"Table for 2, gentlemen."
"Could I see your menu?"
"Certainly."
Sherlock scanned the menu, tracking his finger down its limited listings until...
"Vegetable broth, containing carrots, cabbage and beetroot."
"Sounds most unsatisfying."
"Gentlemen, I assure you the chef seasons the broth with a..."
"Do you know this woman?"
Sherlock held up the photo of the dead woman he had taken from the mortician's file. 2 women on a nearby table gasped in horror.
"Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to leave."
Excuse me, if I may. We are consulting detectives working with Scotland Yard. Now, my colleague here, Mr. Holmes, is merely trying to establish a link between..."
"I read about your escapades in the Strand magazine."
"They're not escapades, they're crimes."
Anyway, as I was saying, we're trying to find out who this woman is. Do you recognise her?"
Yes, she was in here last night."
"Did she dine alone?"
Yes, but she did leave with a gentleman."
"Describe him."
"Well, he was average height, maybe late 20s, smartly dressed in his uniform.
Uniform?
He was a serviceman.
Yes.
What type? Navy, Air Force, infantry?
Oh, I couldn't tell.
Thank you. You've been mildly helpful.
No problem.
Just a second. What's the nearest boarding house to this establishment?
There's one in Gloucester Place, just past the air raid shelter, at the top of the road.
Holmes and I visited the boarding house at 96 Gloucester Place and quickly established our victim's room. Once inside, we were able to make a positive identification from her belongings. She was one Evelyn Hamilton, a 41-year-old chemist from Newcastle-upon-Tyne. Evelyn had arrived in London that evening, planning to stay overnight before travelling to Grimsby to start a new job at a pharmacy. However, fate's cruel timing would bring a tragic end to her story. It was a frosty evening that promised snow which never came. Holmes sat staring into the fire, lost in thought. It had not long passed 11 o'clock, and I had just finished reading an article on Britain's soap rationing. Then, in the distance, we heard that all-too-familiar sound. Mrs. Hudson abruptly entered the room.
Come on then, chaps, let's get down to the cellar.
Holmes, Mrs. Hudson and I spent the rest of the night in the cellar of 221B's residence. Despite the damp and the mould, Mrs. Hudson had managed to make it quite homely down there. She had a flask of tea, bread and jam, cushions and blankets complete with candlelight. The thudding sounds above came in waves.
What are you reading, Sherlock?
The attack on Pearl Harbor.
They attacked it twice?
No, this is an old newspaper from last year.
Why is it down here?
It's mine. I've been saving newspapers since the war started. I figure they may be of some worth in the future.
Well, that explains the pile of them over there.
Well, they ain't going to be worth much if you keep storing them down here. It's too damp. They'll get ruined. I'll bring them up later and sort through them. Who wants a jam sandwich to go with their tea?
Oh, yes. Yes, please.
Sherlock?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
Sherlock? You haven't eaten all day.
The faculties become refined when you starve them.
Oh, that last one sounded a bit too close for comfort.
It's a numbers game. One in every six Londoners will be made homeless from this blitz bombing. Then add the increase of the crime and murder rate. I'd say you have about a 4.1% chance of waking up tomorrow morning.
Oh, my God.
Oh, pay no attention to him, Mrs. Hudson. I'm sure we will be fine.
Numbers don't lie. And let's not forget about our serial killer on the loose.
There's really a serial killer in London? As if we ain't got enough to deal with.
Yes, he's probably out there right now.
You don't really think the killer is going to risk hunting his victim during an air raid attack, do you?
In the midst of chaos, there is opportunity.
None of us slept very well that night in the cramped quarters of the cellar. I was very much looking forward to getting some shut-eye after breakfast, but Lestrade had called for us. Next thing I knew, I found myself in a disorientated daze, both cold and hungry, entering a flat in Soho.
She's through here. I must warn you, gentlemen, it's quite a disturbing scene.
Lestrade ushered us into the one-roomed flat in Wardour Street. It was February the 10th, barely 24 hours before discovering our first victim. The killer had struck again. Only this was a much more horrifying sight. On the bed lay a woman with her throat cut. She had been sexually mutilated with sickening brutality, using a torch, a razor blade, hair tongs, and a tin opener.
Her name's Evelyn Oatley. She was discovered this morning by her neighbour.
We learned that she was an aspiring actress who had left her home for the bright lights of the London stage, only to find those lights dimmed by the war. What kind of man could do this?
Evil is a choice, not a natural state of being.
Sherlock hovered his magnifying glass over the bloody tin opener. Just then, a large, gruff-looking man entered the room.
And who the hell are you two?
The man in question was Chief Inspector Edward Greenough, often referred to as Ted, from the murder squad at Scotland Yard. Lestrade quickly intervened.
Inspector Greenough, this is Dr. Watson and Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, I know them. Holmes, eh? The amateur two-bit detective.
I've been called worse by better.
Lestrade, I'll be taking over this case. You continue to work on finding the Hamilton murderer.
But the killer is one and the same.
What the hell are you talking about, man? Evelyn Hamilton was strangled in an air raid shelter. This woman been cut open in her own home. The murders are completely different.
Because the circumstances were different.
What?
The killer was out in public. Anybody could have walked into that air raid shelter, so time was a factor. He had to move with haste, whereas with this second victim here, he could take his time and carry out all his psychotic fantasies, resulting in a much more deranged and violent death.
With no rebuttal, Inspector Greenough grunted and shrugged as he turned to walk away.
Inspector, you might want to take this tin opener over to your forensic department. I noticed a thumbprint on it. I'm betting it's from a left hand.
Inspector Greenough said nothing. He merely snatched the tin opener up in a handkerchief and walked away. The tin opener was taken to a renowned forensic fingerprint expert, Frederick Cheryl. He found the print to be from the thumb of a left hand, just as Sherlock had predicted. However, no matches could be made against the Met's substantial record of prints, meaning that the killer had no previous criminal record.
Cinemas of Leicester Square are open. But precautions for the safety of London are maintained.
As I sat in the darkness of the Odeon Cinema in Mile End, watching the latest war news, I suddenly realised that the dark had become a constant part of London life. During the day, our grey skies kept us cloaked from any kind of sun, and our nights were blitz black, keeping us safe from our foreign enemies while allowing our own enemies to rise. War was everywhere, and to quote H.G. Wells, if we don't end war, war will end us. The murder had happened in the early hours of Wednesday, 11th of February. It was the third murder in succession. This time, the victim was a prostitute named Margaret Lowe, nicknamed the Lady, due to her refinement and conservative dress sense. She was said to have turned to the streets to help pay for her daughter's boarding school fees. However, the 43-year-old widow's good intentions were met with a cruel fate.
She was killed in her own flat.
Inspector Lestrade continued to lay out the gruesome details.
The victim, Margaret Lowe, was strangled with a silk stocking and her abdomen was ripped open.
Well, that's breakfast over.
Any evidence left behind?
Yes, just like with his second victim. He left behind an array of torture tools. There was a knife and a razor.
Sherlock got up out of his chair and walked over to the window. He stared outside into the street below. The room fell silent and still.
This reminds me of another case.
Which one?
The one that took place here in London, 54 years ago.
Are you talking about Jack the Ripper?
Indeed, this killer shares Jack the Ripper's same sadistic trade in carving up women. They both preyed on prostitutes.
Easy prey, I guess.
They were both left-handed.
It's a frightening thought to think that we could have another Ripper on our street.
And like the murders of Jack the Ripper, the killings have grown ever more violent with each victim.
You think this killer is influenced by the Ripper?
Hard to say. Jack the Ripper's motive was never sexually driven like this killer, but they do share the same barbarous passion to want to punish women.
Yeah, but Scotland Yard never did find Jack the Ripper.
Ah, but you have something that you didn't have back then.
What's that?
Me.
By now, the press had got wind of reports on the four murders committed by the same man roaming the capital, and like Sherlock, they immediately saw parallels with Jack the Ripper. And thus, the tabloids came up with the name the Blackout Ripper.
Come and get your paper. You're seeking new Ripper.
The next evening, Holmes and I were called down to Scotland Yard's forensic department to meet with Frederick Cheryl. He had found more fingerprints of the killer, this time on a candle from the residence of our third victim, Margaret Lowe. As we entered the forensic offices, we were immediately greeted with Inspector Greenough.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I heard you were coming down and thought I'd stop by. Go on then, Fred. Tell them what you found.
Inspector Greenough was gloating for some reason. Frederick Cheryl began to explain his findings.
The fingerprints we found on the candle are from a right hand, so we can't be sure it's the same killer.
Did you hear that, Mr. Holmes? From the right hand. So it's not a foregone conclusion that it's the same killer.
Did you check the candlestick?
What?
No, we didn't.
Wax will naturally glue the candle to its holder, which means you would use the preferred hand to steady the base of the candlestick while pulling the candle out with a non-dominant hand.
Frederick placed the candlestick under the microscope.
He's right, there are prints here. Let me see.
Even Inspector Greenough could not hide how impressed he was with Sherlock's quick deduction.
Yes, it's a left hand, and the prints match.
It's all right, Inspector. Thankfully, stupidity is not a crime.
Look, maybe I was wrong to judge you. I need all the help I can get. We've got to catch this bastard.
And I intend to.
I've just come from the crime scene of Doris Jeanette. She was killed this evening. We believe her to be the fourth victim of the Blackout Ripper. Same methods used, strangled with a scarf and then sexually mutilated with a razor.
Where was this?
In her flat in Sussex Gardens, Paddington. Now, when I arrived, her body was still warm.
Which means the killer was not that far ahead of you.
Here's some photos from the crime scene. Care to take a look?
Sherlock leaned over the photographs carefully, examining them through his magnifying glass.
What is it, Holmes? What did you see?
Everything. It's my curse. What's this?
Holmes pointed to something on a dressing table in the background of one of the photos.
Oh, yeah, that. It's elastoplast. Had a small square cut from it. I suppose she cut her finger or something.
Did you find this elastoplast on her body somewhere?
Nope. Actually, we didn't, but she may have used it a few weeks ago.
I noticed a rash around her neck. Was she wearing any jewellery?
I suspect she may have. There was a broken necklace on the floor. Maybe it came off when he was strangling her.
At that moment, a policeman entered.
Inspector?
What is it, Constable?
There's been an incident. It might be connected to your Blackout Ripper.
The incident in question was of a woman being attacked. Apparently, the man had tried to strangle her on the street. We arrived at the Captain's Cabin public house, near the Trocadero in Piccadilly, just after 1 o'clock. Our victim's name was Mary Haywood, and despite her ordeal, she appeared to be quite calm and collected. She was a very attractive lady, and I must admit to being somewhat smitten by her. Inspector Lestrade saw us from afar and immediately headed towards us.
Holmes, Watson, what are you doing here?
There with me,
interrupted Inspector Greenough.
Go on then, Holmes.
Thank you, Ted, Miss Haywood. It is imperative that you tell me everything that happened last night. And please, spare no detail.
I'll try. I just finished eating at a restaurant. That's when he came up to me. He was offering me money to sleep with him, but I said I wasn't interested. After that, he was actually quite charming. We walked and talked, but then he forced me into a dark alley, and that's when he tried to, I started to hit him, and then he threw me to the floor, and that's it. I blacked out.
Well, that's when the night porter found her unconscious.
Bring over the night porter, Lestrade.
Yes, sir.
Madam, I realise you've been through a traumatic experience, but do you think you may be able to describe him?
Yes. He was slight in build, good-looking, about 5'7". He had green eyes and wore an airman's uniform.
A pilot? Are you sure?
Oh, I recognise the uniform. He's an officer cadet. I could tell by his forage cap.
Very good, Miss Haywood.
Thank you. Call me Mary.
I'm John. We held a gaze that in reality lasted no longer than a second, but for me, time had stopped completely. But the moment was soon broken with the presence of Lestrade and the night porter.
This is the night porter, sir.
What's your name, son?
John Shine, sir.
Go on then, tell us what happened.
Well, I was doing my rounds, and I shone my torch into a doorway and saw a man run away. It was only when I got closer that I noticed a lady lying on the ground.
Did you see the man's face?
No, sir. It was too dark.
Very well. I have no use for you. You can go.
Thank you. Oh, do you want this?
The teenage boy held out a gas mask.
Why would I want this?
He dropped it, sir, when he was running away.
Sherlock's eyes lit up as he grabbed the mask from the boy.
Oi, careful. You'll contaminate the evidence. Could have his fingerprints on it.
My dear Inspector Greenough, we need not worry about fingerprints when we have his name right here.
Holmes held out the gas mask, and stamped upon the inside of it was a number.
525987. That's our pilot's service number.
The mask is registered to him.
Right you are, Watson. Now, if you contact the RAF and ask them to trace the owner of this respirator, I dare say we'll have the identification of our man by tea time tomorrow.
We later found out that the Blackout Ripper attacked another woman after his failed attempt on Mary Haywood. His bloodlust unsatisfied had him prowling the streets looking for another victim when he happened to cross streetwise prostitute Catherine Mulcahy near Paddington Station. Fortunately, she managed to fight him off, and once again, the Blackout Ripper fled into the blackness of the Blitz. It was February the 16th. And the rain drizzled upon the windowpane, creating an ever-so-light pitter-patter sound. The paper's byline read, "The Fall of Singapore." Japanese forces had taken control of the British command post there and had also taken the island of Sumatra. However, nothing could dampen my spirit that morning, as I was to meet Mary for a spot of lunch in the West End. I just finished tying my Bart's tie, that I had not worn since I was a student, when Sherlock unexpectedly swung open my bedroom door and said,
"What's going on here?"
"What does it look like? I'm tying a tie."
"That is what you're doing, but that is not what is going on here."
"Is there any particular reason for why you've barged into my room?"
"Inspector Greenough found our man."
"Really? Where is he?"
"At the RAF reception centre in Regent's Park." "Why are you wearing that tie?"
"Why not this tie?"
"This is your university tie. What's this look on your face, John? I haven't seen it before."
"I haven't got time for this, Sherlock. Have you arrested the man?"
"They have detained him at the barracks. Why did you tie it that way?"
"A knot's a knot."
"A knot is not just a knot, and a man such as yourself knows such things. For the time I have known you, every morning you have used a full Windsor knot in your necktie, which has a formal, business-like representation to it. Yet this morning you are using a Balthus knot that is reserved for more fancy affairs, such as parties, theatre events, or fine dining."
"Not that it's any of your business, but I have a lunch date with Miss Haywood."
"I see. Inspector Greenough will pick us up in 5 minutes. I'll see you and your tie downstairs."
It was the first time I had ever seen Sherlock like this. It was as if he felt threatened by my relationship with Mary. We sat in the back of Inspector Greenough's car in silence. Sherlock was sulking in a childlike manner. There was a certain vulnerability to him. He never could deal well with change. The aircraft reception centre in Regent's Park was within walking distance to the North London areas where these savage attacks had taken place. I was curious to see the man who had done these horrific acts, curious to see the face of evil. Soldiers saluted the commanding officer that guided us through the airfield. It took me back to my years serving in the British forces in India with the 5th Northumberland Fusiliers. However, I have to admit to not missing the regimented lifestyle. The officer led us into the empty barracks, bar a man seated on the edge of his bed at the end of the long room. He was guarded by two Royal Military policemen.
"Are you Gordon Frederick Cummins?"
said Inspector Greenough as the man stood to attention.
"Yes, sir."
He had a soldierly build, with a fresh complexion and dark hair swept back over his forehead, complete with piercing green eyes.
"I'm Chief Inspector Greenough. This is Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, and we're with Scotland Yard. We've got a few questions for you, son. Holmes?"
"Thank you, Ted. Tell me, Mr. Cummins, are you married?"
"Yes, sir. 7 years now."
"And what's her name?"
"Marjorie."
"And what does Marjorie do?"
"She's a secretary to a theatre producer."
"And does she know about your homicidal, psychopathic tendencies?"
Excuse me, sir?"
"I think you heard him just fine."
"I'm not sure what you're talking about."
"Underneath that false upper-class tone, I can still hear the Yorkshireman in you. So when did you transfer to London?"
"Beginning of this year. May I ask what this is about?"
"The thing about lying is your tone gives you away, as it did just then. You see there's a change in pitch that indicates deceit. Is this yours?"
Holmes held out the gas mask.
"Oh, I've been wondering where that went."
"You see, it happened again, only this time with a slight cracking in the voice, which is another trait of lying. This was found at a scene of an attack on a woman a few nights ago."
"Really? Well, I lost that a few weeks back. Somebody else must have picked it up."
"That's a plausible explanation. Would you sign a statement to that effect?"
"Yes, of course."
"Ted, if you would be so kind..."
Inspector Greenough quickly scribbled the statement in his notepad and handed it to Cummins to sign. Holmes approached a window ledge near the bed. He picked up a small wristwatch and casually examined it. He noticed, stuck on the back of the watch, was a small square of elastoplast.
"That's a rather small wristwatch for a man."
"It's my wife's. I keep it with me all the time. That way, it's like she's with me."
"Save the theatrics for the trial. This watch belongs to Doris Duarnay. You see, she had a skin allergy to metal that causes a rash, like the necklace she was wearing the night you attacked her. I theorised that she cut a small square from a roll of elastoplast and stuck it on the back of the watch to separate her skin from the metal. Now, I'm guessing if I was to take this square of elastoplast and place it on the square from the roll we found in her flat, it would be a perfect match."
Let me explain. I was..."
"All the evidence is mounting up, but you already sealed your fate when you signed your statement. You signed with your left hand, and I'm sure that once we run your fingerprints next to the ones found at the crime scenes, they will tell us what you are not."
"Gordon Frederick Cummins, I am arresting you for the murders of Evelyn Hamilton, Evelyn Oatley, Margaret Lowe, and Doris Jeanette. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned about something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do or say may be given in evidence."
Inspector Greenough continued to read Gordon Cummins his rights as he escorted him from the barracks. You know, just being in his presence is a most unpleasant feeling.
"Yes, well, I'm sure you'll be able to shrug off that feeling when you're on a date with his victim."
On April 28th, 1942, the Blackout Ripper was charged at the Old Bailey with 4 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder, to which he pleaded not guilty to each charge. But after only 1 day of trial, the jury took just 35 minutes to reach a verdict.
"Has the jury reached a verdict?"
"We have, Your Honour, and we find the defendant, Gordon Frederick Cummins, guilty of murder in the first degree."
Gordon Cummins was sentenced to death by hanging, but his distressed family, unable to believe the truth, started a campaign to reprieve the death sentence. Cummins even wrote to the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Prime Minister's wife, but all these appeals fell upon deaf ears. I had just entered the Baker Street residence after spending the afternoon with Mary. Our relationship was flourishing. I could not be happier. But then...
Watson, you idiot!
Afternoon, Sherlock.
Why didn't you tell me about these murders?
Sherlock held up two newspapers that I recognized from the pile I'd been collecting in the cellar. Sherlock, I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about.
These murders committed last year in October.
What about them?
What about them? They're done by him.
Who?
The Blackout Ripper. This means that Evelyn Hamerton was not his first victim. His actual first victim was Mabel Church, who was strangled to death by a suspender belt in a bombed-out house in Hampstead.
As I read the gruesome details in the article, I felt a churning in my stomach. Just when I thought we'd closed the chapter on this vicious, sadistic killer, more lost souls had managed to find a way to speak out to us from the dead. You're sure it's him?
It's his handiwork. Look at the second victim, Edith Humphreys, murdered just a few days after Mabel, once again strangled and then her throat cut. She even worked as a cook at the Air Force station, which means he targeted her.
Well, what should we do? I mean, you can't hang him twice.
No, but justice has not been fully served here for those who sought it.
Gordon Cummins remains a grotesque enigma. His violence rivaled that of Jack the Ripper. His killings even more frenzied and almost as prolific. Yet, because of the war and the fact that he was caught quickly, neither his crimes nor his victims received the level of attention as those of his Victorian predecessor. On the morning of June 25th, 1942, just as German warplanes flew overhead, the Blackout Ripper met his fate at the end of the hangman's rope.